Welcome back to Jacko's Stackology, where we talk about concepts in neuroscience and psychology. This is the second part of my clinical neuroanatomy series. Today we're going to be talking about development and cellular constituents of the nervous system. And we also discussed how these maps that we create to establish form and function of the brain, although useful, are not exactly accurate. And we used a lot of big words, a lot of terminology that might be hard to keep up with. And of course, there were a lot of definitions, many of which were disembodied. So it can be difficult to remember all these terms and remember all the different sections of the brain, especially when we use multiple different terms for the same parts of the brain. And that's okay. In this lecture, I'm going to be throwing a lot more information at you. There is going to be some dense stuff, a lot of big words. Try not to get discouraged if you don't recognize any of these. We do have to get through some of this stuff, but here soon we're going to be talking about some of the easier stuff to understand and, in my opinion, the more interesting stuff. Today we're going to be talking about neurons and how they're formed, what they do, how they function, but we do have to get through some of this drier stuff in order to get there. Let's start off with neural development. Early in the development of the nervous system, you have a hollow tube that forms. It's made from ectodermal neural tissue, and it forms at the embryo's dorsal midline, so right at the top there in the middle. The cellular elements of the tube appear to be undifferentiated. It just looks like one sort of mass of cells, but over time they develop into various types of neurons and supporting glial cells. A little bit about this neural tube. It has three layers. The first layer is the ventricular zone, which is later called the ependyma. It's around the lumen, or the central canal of the tube. There's the intermediate zone, which is formed by the dividing cells of the ventricular zone, including the earliest radial glial cell type. And it stretches between the ventricular surfaces and the outer layer, the pial layer. And then third, you have the marginal zone, which is formed later by processes of the nerve cells in the intermediate zone. The intermediate zone, the mantle layer, increases in cellularity and becomes gray matter, while the nerve cell processes in the marginal zone, as well as other cell processes, become white matter once they're myelinated. So remember, in the previous lecture, we were talking about that myelination, or that coating in fat. It's insulation of the neurons around their axons. This is that process. So during the formation of neural development, we have to talk about cell differentiation and migration, because we want to know how are the cells becoming different structures, and also how do they know where they're going. So the largest neurons, which are mostly motor neurons, are the first to differentiate. They're the first to become different specialized neurons. The sensory and small neurons, and most of the glial cells, appear later, up to the time of birth. Newly formed neurons may migrate extensively through regions of previously formed neurons. They tend to provide more structure, and they're also given a bit of a scaffolding with which to build off of. When glial cells appear, they can also act as a framework that guides growing neurons to the correct target areas. Because the axonal process of a neuron may begin growing towards its target during cell migration, nerve processes in the adult brain are often curved rather than straight. Neurons are a very specialized cell. So we've talked about these throughout the last session, and we're going to talk about them all this session, and really we're going to talk about them throughout this entire series. The entire body is made up of cells. That's all it is. And all these different cells are specialized for different purposes. The neuron is a specialized cell for the nervous system. Your brain, your spinal cord, are entirely made of neurons, and these neurons even create the nerves that will extend off to your peripheral nervous system. So neurons can vary in size and complexity. However, they all follow a similar basic structure. Motor neurons are usually longer than sensory neurons. Nerve cells with the really long processes, the really long axons, such as dorsal root ganglion cells that run down your spine, are larger than those with short processes. Some neurons project from the cerebral cortex to the lower spinal cord, which is a distance of 3 feet or sometimes more in adults, and others have very short processes, reaching, for example, only from one cell to another cell in the cerebral cortex. So sometimes these cells can be very, very long, sometimes these cells can be very, very short. And it's pretty amazing to think about, considering if you know anything about, or if you remember anything from previous biology courses, you know that a cell has to maintain a specific size. It can't be any larger than a specific size before the cell starts to break down and doesn't work efficiently. So somehow, a neuron, a single cell, can run from your brain all the way to the bottom of your spine and not break that rule. It's still thin enough that it meets that surface area, which is kind of wild to think about. These small neurons that have the short axons and terminate locally, the ones that are between cells in the cerebral cortex, these are known as interneurons. So many processes, or those branches that extend from the cell body, are called axons and dendrites, depending on what their function is. Most neurons give rise to a single axon and many dendrites. The dendritic zone, the part of the neuron where all the dendrites are, is part of the neuron that receives information. These dendrites may have one or more collateral branches, so not only are they branches off of the cell, but they also have branches that come off of them and extend to other neurons. If we look at the axon, downstream from the cell has these synaptic terminals where the cell ends and connects to another neuron. These synaptic terminals, or aberration, go by many names. I've often heard them be called synaptic boutons, which are the little spots on the end of the cell where neurotransmitters are released from. So a proper understanding of how the brain functions requires that we have a good understanding of how neurons work. And although they all have a similar structure, they vary in how that structure is laid out, and they all have a similar function as well. So, for the sake of simplicity, I will talk about the neuron's typical function. So, although some specialized neurons are set up a little bit differently, most neurons will follow the rules as I set them down for you now. So first, let's talk about the neuronal cell body, otherwise known as the soma. The soma is the metabolic and genetic center of the neuron. Like any other cell, it holds the nucleus and most organelles, which will be responsible for creating the various proteins that will go throughout the cell. The cell body, along with the dendrites, create the receptive pole of the neuron. That's the region of the neuron that actually receives the information. Dendrites, again, are the branches of the neuron that extend from the cell body. They are the parts of the cell that receive incoming information. In the previous lecture, we talked about a little bit how that information can be inhibitory or excitatory. It can either stop the cell from firing, or it can excite the cell and make it more likely to fire. Many dendrites give rise to what are called dendritic spines, which are small little mushroom-shaped projections that act as fine dendritic branches, and they're the actual structures that receive synaptic inputs. These spines are actually very important. The shape of the spine and its size help to determine its efficacy, how good it will be at transmitting information, or how good it will be at receiving information. A synapse onto the tip of a spine with a thin neck will have a smaller influence than a synapse onto a spine with a thick neck. The quantity and the density of these spines is also important for the efficacy of transmission through the next cell. Changes in dendritic spine shape can strengthen synaptic connections so as to contribute to learning and memory. Maladaptive changes in spines may contribute to altered function of the nervous system after injury. A single axon, or a nerve fiber, arises from most neurons. This axon is a long extension arising from the neuron, cylindrical tube of cytoplasm covered by a membrane, otherwise known as the axolemma. A cytoskeleton, consisting of neurofilaments and microtubules, runs through the axon, providing its structure. There are also specialized molecular motors, called kinesin molecules, that bind to vesicles, which are containing the neurotransmitters inside of the cell, that are destined for transport via a series of adenosine triphosphates, or ATP, consuming steps along the microtubules. So in the axon, you have a series of structures called microtubules. They provide a framework throughout the axon. And these kinesin molecules will bind to these pockets of neurotransmitter that are being created in the cell body. And using ATP function, right, which is the adenosine triphosphate, it's called triphosphate because it has three phosphate groups bound to it. And it's easy for it to lose a phosphate group through this process, and it becomes a diphosphate. That diphosphate can then easily pick up a new phosphate, turning it back into a triphosphate. And so as this structure is losing a phosphate and gaining a phosphate and losing a phosphate and gaining a phosphate, it's changing its overall molecular structure, allowing it to sort of ratchet along these microfibers. And that's what allows these kinesin molecules to grapple a vesicle filled with neurotransmitter and carry it down the axon process to the synaptic terminal. The axon conducts electrical signals, which are called action potentials, from the initial segment, which is distinctive in morphological feature. The initial segment is the part of the axon directly branching off of the cell body or the soma. And that part where it connects to the soma is known as the axon hillock. This is the region where the majority of the excitatory postsynaptic potentials and inhibitory postsynaptic potentials occur and become integrated. And if there is enough excitatory information, an action potential will be fired. So many of these axons are covered in myelin. Myelin consists of multiple concentric layers of lipid-rich membrane produced by Schwann cells in the peripheral nervous system, or oligodendrocytes, which are a type of glial cell in the central nervous system. The way that Schwann cells and oligodendrocytes are connected to the axon are fundamentally different in the central nervous system and the peripheral nervous system. In the central nervous system, one single oligodendrocyte may provide myelination for multiple neurons, and this also helps to provide structure to the brain and spinal cord. However, in the peripheral nervous system, where the Schwann cells are, each Schwann cell acts as its own insulator around a particular axon. So in the PNS, you will have nerves with axons that have a bunch of Schwann cells myelinating a single axon. And in the CNS, you will have a bunch of oligodendrocytes myelinating a single axon, but also myelinating other axons as well. These little segments of myelination have gaps between them. These small gaps between them are known as nodes of Ranvier. The nodes of Ranvier are the areas where saltatory conduction occurs. Saltatory means that the nerve signal, that the electrical signal, is sort of able to jump across myelinated regions to each node of Ranvier, allowing for synaptic transmission to be even faster than it already is. So a bit about this axonal transport. Not only do axons carry an action potential, but they also transport materials from the cell body to the synaptic terminals. This is what we call anterograde transport. And from the synaptic terminals to the cell body, which is what we call retrograde transport. It is generally thought that ribosomes are not present in the axon, and that this new protein must be synthesized and moved to the axon. This occurs using various types of axonal transport, which will differ depending on what kind of material is being transported. Sometimes an axon can be injured by being cut or severed, or even crushed or compressed. After injury, the neuronal cell body responds by entering a phase called axon reaction, or chromatolysis. In general, axons with peripheral nerves can regenerate quickly after they are severed, whereas those within the CNS do not tend to regenerate. The axon reaction and axonal regeneration are further discussed later. Once that information has been carried across the axon, all the materials and the electrical signal, or the electrochemical signal, we reach the synapses. This is where the transmission of information between neurons occurs. This interneuronal complex between the presynaptic neuron, which is communicating to the postsynaptic neuron, this little region where they communicate across is known as a synaptic junction, or some people just call it a synapse or a synapse. Some synapses are even located between an axon and a dendrite. In that case, they're known as axodendritic synapses. Some synapses are located between an axon and a nerve cell body. We call these axosomatic synapses, and they tend to be more inhibitory. Some synapses are located between an axon terminal and another axon. These axoaxonic synapses modulate transmitter release by the postsynaptic axon. This synaptic transmission permits information from many presynaptic neurons to converge onto a single postsynaptic neuron. Some neuronal large cell bodies receive several thousand synapses. So, depending on the type of synapse, some postsynaptic neurons will receive information through the use of neurotransmitters, while other postsynaptic neurons receive information through the use of voltage. And in these regions where current passes directly from cell to cell are known as specialized junctions called electrical synapses, or sometimes gap junctions. These are the most common synapses in invertebrate nervous systems. Chemical synapses in the mammalian system have distinctive characteristics in that they include synaptic vesicles on the presynaptic side, a synaptic cleft, and a dense thickening of the cell membrane on both the receiving cell and the presynaptic cell. Synaptic vesicles contain neurotransmitters, and each vesicle contains a small packet or a quanta of neurotransmitter. These are the chemical signals that will be received by the postsynaptic cell. When the synaptic terminal is depolarized by an action potential, there is an influx of calcium. This calcium influx leads to a phosphorylation of proteins called synapsins. After this phosphorylation of synapsin occurs, synaptic vesicles are able to dock at the presynaptic membrane facing the synaptic cleft. They then fuse with it and release their neurotransmitter out into the synaptic gap. Synapses are very diverse in their shape and their properties, and some are inhibitory and others are excitatory. Sometimes the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, and other times it's catecholamine, amino acid, or some other substance. And in addition to this calcium-dependent vesicular neurotransmitter release that we just talked about, there's also a second non-vesicular mode of neurotransmitter release that is not calcium-dependent. This mode of release depends on what are called transporter molecules, which usually serve to take up transmitter from the synaptic cleft. These can sometimes take transmitter from the synaptic cleft back into the presynaptic neuron, and other times into the postsynaptic neuron. In the cerebellar cortices, cell bodies aggregate to form layers called laminas. Nerve cell bodies in the brainstem, the spinal cord, and the cerebrum form compact groups, also called nuclei. Each nucleus contains projection neurons whose axons carry impulses to other parts of the nervous system and inner neurons, which act as short relays within the nucleus. In the PNS, these compact groups of nerve cell bodies are known as ganglia. We talked a little bit about this in the last lecture, but I'll cover it again here. These groups of nerve cells are connected by pathways formed by bundles of axons. In some pathways, the axon bundles are sufficiently defined to be identified as tracts or fasciculi. In others, there are no discrete bundles of axons. These aggregates of tracts in the spinal cord are referred to as columns or funiculi. Within the brain, certain axon tracts are referred to as limniski. And in some regions of the brain, axons are sort of intermingled with dendrites, and they don't really run in bundles that are easy to identify. They're more web-like, and they're known as neuropil. Let's take a moment to talk about specialized cells known as glia, which, if you remember, are these supporting cells in the nervous system. Neuroglia, or just glial cells, outnumber neurons in the brain and spinal cord about 10 to 1. They do not form synapses, and they play a number of important roles, including myelin formation, guidance of developing neurons, maintenance of extracellular potassium levels, and the reuptake of transmitters after synaptic activity. But basically speaking, there are two broad classes of glial cells, which fall under macroglia and microglia. Let's first talk about macroglia. The term macroglia refers to astrocytes and oligodendrocytes, which are both derived from ectoderm. These cells may have the capability, under some circumstances, to regenerate, unlike neurons. Of the astrocytes, there are also two more categories, protoplasmic and fibrous. Protoplasmic astrocytes tend to be more delicate and have many processes that are branched and make up gray matter. Whereas fibrous astrocytes are more fibrous, hence the name, and their processes, which contain glial fibrils, are seldomly branched. Astrocytes have processes that radiate in all directions from the cell body, and they tend to surround blood vessels in the nervous system and cover the exterior surface of the brain and spinal cord below the pia. These cells provide structural support to nervous tissue and act during development as guide wires that direct neuronal migration. They maintain appropriate concentrations of potassium within the extracellular space and also play a role in synaptic transmission. Many synapses are closely invested by astrocytic processes, which appear to participate in the reuptake of neurotransmitters back into the presynaptic cell. Although we'll talk about this a little more later on, astrocytes also surround endothelial cells within the central nervous system, which are joined by tight junctions that impede the transport molecules across the capillary epithelium and contribute to the formation of the blood-brain barrier. Astrocytes cover the entire central nervous system surface and proliferate within damaged nervous tissue. These reactive astrocytes tend to be larger and are more easily stained and can be definitively identified in histological sections because they contain a characteristic astrocyte-specific protein known as glial fibrillary acidic protein, or GFAP. Chronic astrocytic proliferation leads to gliosis, sometimes called glial scarring. Whether glial scarring is beneficial or inhibits regeneration of injured neurons is currently being studied. Now let's talk about oligodendrocytes, the second class of macroglia. We've already talked about these a little bit and how they help to provide myelination. These predominate in white matter. They extend arm-like processes which wrap tightly around axons, extruding the oligodendroglial cytoplasm to form a compact sheath of myelin, which acts as an insulator around the axons of the CNS. They may also provide some nutritive support, and a single oligodendrocyte may wrap myelin sheaths around many axons, up to 30 or 40. In the peripheral nervous system, we have a myelin sheath that's formed by Schwann cells, where each Schwann cell myelinates a single axon, and remyelination can occur at a brisk pace after injury to the myelin or the peripheral nerves. Now that we've talked about macroglia, why don't we talk about microglia? So microglial cells are macrophage-like cells, or scavengers of the central nervous system. They're constantly surveying the brain and the spinal cord and acting as sentries to detect and destroy invaders, such as bacteria. When an area of the brain or spinal cord is damaged or infected, microglia activate and migrate to the site of injury to remove cellular debris. Some microglia are always present in the brain, but when injury or infection occurs, others enter the brain from blood vessels. Because microglia are important for protecting the nervous system, their role after endogenous insult, such as a stroke or some sort of neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's, is under investigation. We should also discuss extracellular space, which accounts for about 20% of the total volume of the brain and spinal cord. Transmembrane gradients of ions, such as potassium and sodium, are important in electrical signaling in the nervous system, and regulation of these levels in the external compartment is an important function. We call this ionic homeostasis, which is at least in part performed by astrocytes. The blood-brain barrier, which isolates the brain's extracellular space from the intravascular compartment, is impermeable to diffusion created by the tight junctions that are formed by capillary endothelial cells. So let's talk about degeneration and regeneration. The neuronal cell body maintains the function and anatomic integrity of the axon. So if the axon is ever cut, the part that is distal to the cut degenerates. We call this Wallerian degeneration, because materials for maintaining the axon, which are mostly proteins, are formed in the cell body and can no longer be transported down the axon via axoplasmic transport. After injury to the axon, the cell body, or the soma, exhibits distinct sets of histological changes, which have been termed an axon reaction, or chromatolysis. These changes include swelling of the cell body and nucleus, which is usually displaced from the center of the cell to an eccentric location. The regular arrays of ribosome-studded endoplasmic reticulum, or ER, which characterize most neurons, are dispersed and replaced by polyribosomes. In association with the axon reaction, in some CNS neurons, there is a detachment for afferent synapses, swelling of nearby astrocytes, and activation of microglia. Successful axonal regeneration does not commonly occur after injury in the central nervous system. It appears that this failure of central nervous system axons to regenerate is not due to an intrinsic inability of these cells to regrow, but rather to the presence in the neighborhood of central nervous system axons of factors that block or inhibit axonal regeneration. Many neurons appear to be dependent on connection with appropriate target cells. If the axon fails to regenerate and form a new synaptic connection with the correct postsynaptic cells, the axotomized neuron may become disorganized so that it functions improperly or dies of atrophy. When talking about regeneration of these neurons, let's first speak about peripheral nerves. Regeneration is the nerve's ability to regrow toward an appropriate target, including the reestablishment of its functionality. Shortly after an axon is cut, the tips of the proximal stumps form enlargements, or growth cones. The growth cones send out exploratory pseudopodia that are similar to the axonal growth cones formed in normal development. Each growth cone is able to form many branches that continue to advance away from the site of the original cut. If these branches can cross the scar tissue that enter the distal nerve stump, successful regeneration with restoration of function may occur. The importance of axonal regeneration through Schwann cell tubes surrounded by basal lamina in the distal stump explains the different degrees of regeneration that are seen after nerve crush compared with nerve transection. After a crushing injury to a peripheral nerve, the axons may be severed, but the Schwann cells surrounding basal lamina and perineurium maintain continuity through the lesion, facilitating regeneration of axons through the injured nerve. If the nerve is cut, with the continuity of these pathways disrupted, even with meticulous surgery, it can be difficult to align the proximal and distal parts of each axon's pathway. Successful regeneration is, therefore, less likely. As for the central nervous system, axonal regeneration is typically abortive in the CNS. When neurons in the brain and spinal cord are damaged, they tend to be degraded. Classical neuropathologists suggest that the glial scar, which is largely formed by astrocytic processes, may be partly responsible for this. The properties of oligodendrocytes, in contrast to Schwann cells, may also account for the differences in regenerative capacity. It is now understood and appreciated that molecules such as NOGO act as stop signs that inhibit regeneration of axons within the brain and spinal cord. The neutralization of NOGO molecules has been shown to promote the regeneration of axons within the spinal cord in experimental animals. These CNS axons can regenerate for at least a few centimeters, and some of these can even establish synaptic connections with appropriate target cells. What about the regeneration of myelin, or remyelination? In some disorders, such as Guillain-Barré syndrome, demyelination interferes with conduction. This condition is often followed by remyelination by Schwann cells, which are capable of elaborating new myelin sheaths. In contrast, remyelination occurs much more slowly, if at all, in the central nervous system. Very little remyelination occurs within demyelinated plaques within the brain and spinal cord in multiple sclerosis. A different form of plasticity, such as molecular reorganization of the axon membrane that acquires sodium channels in demyelinated zones, appears to underlie clinical remission in which there is neurological improvement in patients with multiple sclerosis. As for collateral sprouting, this phenomenon has been demonstrated in the central nervous system as well as the peripheral nervous system. It occurs when innervated structures have been partially denervated. The remaining axons then form new collaterals, re-innervate the denervated part of the end organ. This kind of regeneration demonstrates that there is considerable plasticity in the nervous system, and that one axon can take over the synaptic sites formerly occupied by another. Finally, I'd like to discuss neurogenesis. Neurogenesis, or the capability to produce new neurons from undifferentiated proliferative progenitor cells, has been thought to be confined to the development period that precedes the birth of mammals. According to this traditional view, after pathological insults that result in neuronal death, the number of neurons is permanently reduced. However, some recent evidence suggests that a small number of neuronal precursor cells, capable of dividing and then differentiating into neurons, may exist in the forebrain of adult mammals, including humans. These rare precursor cells reside in the subventricular zone. For example, there is some evidence for postnatal neurogenesis in the dentate gyrus of the hippocampus, and it has been suggested that the rate of generation of new neurons in this critical region can be accelerated in an enriched environment. While the number of new neurons that can be produced within the adult human brain is still being debated, the existence of these precursor cells may suggest strategies for restoring function after injury to the CNS. This is an area of intense research.